Thank you. I want to mention that we don't have Jan Greenberg's books here tonight, but we do have 4 copies of Bob Dyer's Oracle of the Turtle and about 4 copies of Vicki Hudspeth's White and Nervous. And so if you liked what you heard tonight, we've had a wonderful, varied program, and it's my pleasure to introduce Vicki Hudspeth. She was born in Winterset, Iowa, and in the last 10 years since she's been in New York City, she has moved from being a Gal Friday in the Garment District to being production director for Cosmopolitan magazine. In that same period, she has been the author of the poetry chapbook, White and Nervous, the poetry book, White and Nervous, and a poetry chapbook, Fresh Roasted Peanuts. She has been active as a poet, editor, and director at the St. Mark's Poetry Project for the past 6 years. She edited the St. Mark's newsletter for 2 years and co-edited an anthology, Knock Knock, a funny anthology by serious writers, with Madeline Keller. Vicki is also a director of plays and films. She directed 2 plays for the Eye and Ear Theater, which produces plays by poets with sets by artists, and the poets' works were James Schuyler and John Ashbery, with sets by artists Alex Katz and Jane Freilicher. This summer, Vicki wrote, produced, and directed a short film called Poultrygeist, exploring the rise and fall of baby chicken yellow. Without further ado, I hope you'll join me in welcoming Vicki Hudspeth.
Sorry, baby chicken yellow couldn't make it tonight. Hollywood, you know. My friend Tom Sedita and I were driving into town today, and we started talking about one poem that I like to read a lot and that I like to start readings with, which is about Woolworths. And we were contemplating whether or not there were any Woolworths left, and if they had all been replaced by Kmart. But then as we were driving across town tonight, we saw a wonderful-looking Woolworths that seemed to still be full of lots of goodies and in very good shape. So we were happy to see that. And I'd like to start with a poem called Woolworths. Waiting for Margaret to drive up in her VW, Margaret the doctor, Margaret the runner. So working backwards, I had a revolting lunch in Woolworths. Woolworths, David asked incredulously. You had lunch in Woolworths? Yes, I say. I figured it couldn't be that bad. I was buying potting soil and starving, so I tried a tuna melt. I asked for it on whole wheat, and it came back on white with American cheese. After croaking down a half of the sandwich with one eye on the photo booth, which is really what I wanted to do in Woolworths, and was deciding which cashier I would try and get quarters out of, I looked around the counter. A woman was drinking her coffee with a spoon, and her other hand was poised in a funny way, like giving the peace sign in the 60s, except her 2 fingers were wiggling like insect antennae. Next to her was an old woman with blue hair and violet rhinestone earrings. On my right, 2 women were eating liver and onions and green beans from a can. Then everyone started eating desserts like pumpkin pie and cheesecake. I headed for the photo booth. You get 4 shots for 75 cents now, but this woman kept peeking in at me. As Stuppy says, when you're in the photo booth, it's like a sitting with Avedon. And here was this woman spying on my vanity. Finally, she stuck her head in the booth and asked if they cost 75 cents or 80 cents. I said, please, can't you see the lights flashing? And pulled the curtain closed. But the curtain is cut short so you won't steal or do obscene shots. Anyway, my concentration was ruined, so I bought the potting soil and went back to my office burping. Spent half an hour or so playing in the dirt, thinking about all the signs plastered all over Woolworths that said 1879 to 1979. Thank you, America. Happy Easter. Politics. What a season it is. I don't want to take any risks. Businessmen flourish. I have drinks with them. Hunky-dory. They elected this, little Eisenhower dummies. You want to do something great, but you look in the mirror, and this doesn't look like someone you'd pick out in the crowd and get the hots for. It looks more like someone you'd have to get to know. I'm on my way to the urologist, who will probably want to do something painful to me. Three people I know have mothers who are in the hospital. Families make such large shapes. Who could guess what shape the combination of Mary and Frank would make? I don't have any literary references because I don't read anything except New York Magazine and the newspapers. Metabolism is a dangerous thing, and I blame this for my not being able to read. It's different this year. The American dream fell permanently asleep. It's so tragic. If only I had more free time and a few connections, then I could do something really great. And you know this is just a one-sided joke. Cartoons amuse me. On Saturday morning, propped up with pillows and coffee, wasted time just like elevators. Cartoons were the sacred moment of the week when I was a gluttonous baby kid. It's kind of sunny today and cold as hell. I'm stalling, putting on the new expensive shoes I have to wear all day and night to this dinner of little Eisenhower's. It seems so hopeless to get dressed up. Sometimes you think you're taking a short sidetrack, that it will pay off and you'll get back to writing. And then 4 months later, you realize it's just you and the little Eisenhowers, and they don't have a clue about who you are. And there you sit, projecting just an epidermal layer. Oh boy, first you care, and then you don't, and then you do. A couple years ago, I decided to write one poem a day, kind of like a haiku that would be like a little brushstroke of what the mood of the day had been. And I'm just going to read you one of those that I still like a lot, called December 10th. The sheet of plastic taped over my bedroom window billows and crackles as cold winter wind blows. Outside, an empty aluminum can sounds like wind chimes in summer as it rolls on the sidewalk. It seems like, from the way this reading is going, that I spend a lot of time in really terrible restaurants. But it's not true. I really do have nice meals in nice restaurants. It's just that the bad ones really stand out. This is called Brunch at Paco's. I was late and rushed into a stuffy little room run by a woman who called it an office. Behind a cellophane door were drinks and more people I couldn't distinguish. It was such a beautiful day, a strong March day with a full head of spring and winter still there. I made a numb excuse about needing to cool off after just saying how cold it was outside and said I'd go get myself a soda after she had just said there were drinks in the other room. I backed out the door, drumming up some errand, suddenly thinking about a Bloody Mary and how much I had wanted one in the wretched Mexican place called Paco's, where I had brunch in which I became a horse's ass, sort of, because it was like getting tomato sauce poured over two raw eggs and calling it huevos rancheros. Two women at the bar had wonderful-looking Bloody Marys, but when the waiter ordered ours, he plainly said, two brunch Bloody Marys, which means they don't put any vodka in them. The entire atmosphere was depressing me by the second. I ate two bites of runny eggs, and our conversation disintegrated into loyalty. The waiter thought I was flirting with him when I was really trying to get him to take the plate away. When he finally got the drift, he asked what was wrong. I said, they're not great. They're runny. I can't eat them. Anything wrong with them? He asked again. They're not great, I said, getting hysterical. I wanted to say, why don't you throw in a Bloody Mary with some real vodka in it as a prize for the eggs? Instead, I looked blankly down at the empty table where the oval plate had been. Joni was still bravely trying to eat, but was smoking a cigarette to build up her stamina for the second half. This December. It's not so much that this December wind cuts tunnels out of familiar streets. There are so many people who know you and care that winter is carving its place. It's a blur. Things go by. There are men who want to hold you and tenderly, sleeping off winter, the December, the melancholy. Everything's fairly successful, so you feel left out. Be all over the place for a while and drift. Oh, dangerous drift. The only decent thing to do. Where will you go for the holidays? any port in a storm, where will you go? Then as we lay on our backs trying to say simple things with our bodies, our heads complicate us at every turn. 100 Chinese watercolors, so delicate the cold leaks through the rice paper. When I want him the most, he wants me the least, so I work hard till the balance changes. This helps our light touch, our tenderness. You are so smart, I would love to dance with you right now, but you are already dancing. Even if December didn't snow, it would drift. I'm not saying this to be bitter. I'm trying to paint a portrait of now, to say it's only human, what we are, how we blend together. This is the most mysterious part of all. Two cheeks pressed feel better than tongues and lips this time, this kiss. But there are afternoons and little sleep, not much to say on the telephone. Like thick wool, you fit me snugly, you fit right. This isn't the kind of month to glide on top of, or the men you simply fuck. If you want to ask questions, you have to think of some. I imagine you are dancing, and I am busy being busy right now. It's miserable being so loved and cared for and wanting to get away from this December. That's the kind of poem you write after you've just directed two plays with 15 people in them. And I also read it more or less in preparation to this next piece, which is written in three sections, and it's called The Facade of a New Iran. And my first real job out of school was teaching English in Tehran, and it took me about 5 years to write this piece. The first and last sections were actually written when I was, 21, and I was over there. And the middle section was written 5 years ago when I was already in New York. One. It snowed last night on top of the mountains. Only rain was left to us here in the ingrown parts. It's thundering today like the plains, always ready to let some temper fly. Two men work with picks over there while a woman stands in her morning gown at the window facing the city, checking the haze. Now two shovels appear. No temperamental reasoning. Work till you die. Two wives, 14 children, sometimes a breath ahead, sometimes two. By 26, a man has usually found out. You can marry him then. If he is of the kind that will never know, you will know by then. Rich black smoke is in the air. Some men have only athletic concepts of teams, football teams, soccer teams, bed teams. He'll expect you to adore him and hate you like a tough salesman with an easy client if you do. Today the air and clouds are Midwestern nimble. They want to take you home to get that 26 boy who knows and you know he knows. The men are picking the way of a freeway slowly up the mountain. They die like nicks against it. When she read my palm, she said, "You'll be successful 5 attempts away. This is the first. I feel tired." She looks at her own unsuccessful hand. Two dark-haired women on the next roof in bedclothes. It is the beginning of afternoon. Do they know he doesn't know? Like arid bright birds, they lean on their perch, a pastel blue and contact pink. In 6 months, I will be able to leave. "Goodbye, Joe," she whispers and combs her hair. Two. On most mornings, I get up before dawn. In the dark, out behind the walls of our grounds, dog packs roam through the village, disappearing into the mountains. I am standing half-dressed on the second-floor terrace, then go back in and unplug the vape, electric mosquito killer, and look for any dead ones. Since there are no coffee filters, I strain hot water through paper towels, which always disintegrates. Another day of teaching Iranians their death language. One of my roommates, Jenny, and I decided as we were taking turns sleeping in the cab coming home to call the school a laundromat, since one day all but 2 of the 10 teacher CIA agents were moved into nebulous little offices with phones. American housewives were dredged up at a third the salary to teach English, their only qualification being native. At lunch, a long horse-faced woman said she had tried suicide 3 times since she came to Iran. An American guy sat in the corner reading 100 Years of Solitude. In Scott's junior high school, discussing the virtues of suicide became more common than playing ball. Before I left for Iran, friends begged me not to go there, saying women were treated unfairly. I said that seemed to be true everywhere, and one cannot allow that to inhibit moving. But men constantly knocked into me on the street, and once an Iranian girl and I were almost run over by 2 cars at the same time because the drivers were pretending to run us down. They stopped because their cars almost collided. Some women got so angry that they started slugging men in the market. I did too when I could catch one. Batul said, Iranian men always run away, and it was true. One time, an American woman in Tehran had her breast grabbed by an Iranian on a motorcycle who kept riding. In pain, she kicked the wheel of the motorcycle and toppled him. A policeman reprimanded her, saying, it is very dangerous to kick over a man on his motorcycle. Afghani men don't run away, though, and they hit back. The covering for a woman is much more complete in Afghanistan. Even her eyes are hidden by a black embroidered screen. Women shuffle quietly through the village. When a woman buys something, there is a hissing sound, which is her voice. Then an arm comes out from under the chador. Men, on the other hand, jauntily wear Western pants and attitudes. They have had the streets for thousands of years and are not happy to share it. Almost instinctively, when he sees a woman in Western dress, a man will say things like, you look like a donkey's prick. It's a real treat the first time that happens. After 2 weeks of waiting for my papers in Herat, I felt I'd go mad if I saw one more ghost woman moving silently through the streets. My students told me that women should not wear Western clothing because if a woman's head is uncovered, she doesn't know God. If she doesn't know God, then she's the same as a dog or a donkey and can be kicked or beaten with impunity, since dogs carry disease in the Middle East. The Iranian women and students were not allowed to wear chador in the classroom and so sat straddling history. The men, like third-grade boys, punched at each other with pencils. In the heart of expensive downtown Tehran, the surrounding mountains disappear in a puff of diesel exhaust by 10 a.m., and your skin develops a rash. You think you're getting feeble and crazy from all the Muslims shouting and throwing rocks at you, but it's only the altitude, dope, food, and celibacy. We called Tehran Dodge City because people seemed to make the rules up as they went along, and mostly everyone carried guns. Iranian people couldn't move forward fast enough toward technology, and they couldn't go back, and so seemed caught in a kind of cultural collision. There were all the facades of real business, but in the event of a car accident, it was impossible to collect from the facade of an insurance company, or the facade of women putting down the veil and then having to be guarded from attack coming and going. Iranian pop music played in all the taxis, which had rickrack balls hanging from the windshield, as well as a photo of the royal family. The photos of the Shah and Empress were rigged to make the Shah look taller than he was. In actuality, the Empress is taller by about 4 inches. All the photos show her standing behind him downhill. When one of our roommates moved back to the States, we interviewed an Indonesian man who was teaching only the physical aspects of yoga, not religion. He got a call that evening from a government office saying his working visa had been approved and to come get it. When he got to the office, he was told that he had been deported to Beirut and had 24 hours to leave. Beirut was in the throes of heavy fighting at the time. Since he was an Indonesian with a third-class British passport, there was no government to protect him, and he had to leave. That's when I began to love the American passport. The school wanted teachers to wear uniforms, but this was shouted down because in Isfahan, the teachers who wore red blazers became targets and were shot. The Shah traveled everywhere by helicopter and never traveled alone, so 6 or 7 helicopters would go tilling by. Traffic on the ground was always jammed and made government officials sitting ducks for attacks. One was shot to death in his car the morning I went to walk in the mountains with an Iranian teacher. He had been one of the original 10 within our school and began to spill the details of his involvement with it. Later, he had a nervous breakdown in front of his students. The difference in abundance between shops in neighboring Afghanistan and Iran was remarkable, though. Bins in Tehran were overflowing with staples like chickpeas and grains, though chickpeas were loaded down with rocks to make them weigh more. It was a household ritual to sit and pick the rocks out before cooking. I spent many afternoons drinking tea in the rug shops with misshapen lumps of sugar in it. Every carpet merchant was certain you couldn't pass up buying his rugs. It took me 4 months to figure out that Mansour, the first name for a man, was originally the mispronounced French title Monsieur. Television Farsi was wonderful, and I loved the commercials with Arabic spelled out in computer typefaces. Along the sides of the streets are the jubes, little gutters that are supplied with runoff water from the mountains. The farther one is from the mountain, the dirtier the water is in the jube. Pistachios are soaked in the jute and then dried in the sun on huge towels. Once I saw a man washing his false teeth in the jute, and women wash clothes there too. Then there were the single-stall bread shops where long, flat bread of refined white flour was made. This was a snob item, since people in Afghanistan ate whole wheat bread. When entering a shop, one would ask, "Bread you don't have, do you?" Sentences always carried the negative expectation, and I often wondered if this sentence structure dated back to leaner times. Bishu, Jenny's Indian husband, was a civil engineer helping to solve a sewage system dilemma. All the recently built buildings were using an ancient sand filtering system consisting of large holes dug into the sandy ground and refilled with a porous mixture of sand. Consequently, Tehran is built on ship, and most of the new buildings are uphill. The buildings are constructed from U.S. imported girders split in half. The halves are then scalloped, and the scallops are melted down into something else. Persians practically invented the vaulted arch, but very little remains except the floors of skyscrapers, which are constructed of bricks made of sand, donkey shit, and straw. The bricks are then vaulted between the girders to form the floor. One weekend, 12 of us, Iranian, Armenian, and American, went to the Caspian Sea. In order to travel, we had to rent an entire Greyhound bus, and in order to stay somewhere, rent an entire house. Iranian agents were around us all weekend.